Okay, let me begin by reading a quote to you by Max Harris. It goes like this. Do you know who Max Harris is? Late journalist from South Australia, famous atheist, sort of art critic. Yes or no? He was quite well known for a while there. But anyway, Max Harris says this. Christians are a dim, ego-tripping minority which is dead set on telling everyone why they ought to become Christians instead of finding out why they're not. What do you think? Oh, you may not share his sentiment. What do you think of his basic suggestion? That they are a dim, ego-tripping minority which is dead set on telling everyone why they ought to become Christians instead of finding out why they're not. The way in which we've often done mission to young people has been to go to them and to tell them why they ought to become Christians, to commend to them, to commend the gospel or the church or the morals or the framework for reality that the church and Christianity specifically can offer them. So we go to them and we tell them what we've got to offer them. Here we have an atheist, a non-Christian person, not a young person when he said that, I realise, but I think that he might speak on behalf of young people when he says, what I'd love is for some Christians to come to me and just find out why I'm not a Christian. Just listen to me. Just respect me enough to recognise that I have considered some of these issues and thought them through. In beginning to learn to communicate to young people, I think that one of the significant things we need to recognise is that the way we have done it has been rather paternalistic and patronising and somewhat based on the old sort of British imperialistic colonial age. That's how we got evangelised, and we do it to young people, that's how we'll do it. We'll go and tell them what they should know. But the fact of the matter is, and if you're in my last session on outreach, I'll just reiterate some of that. What we're now discovering is that they're going through schools where they're not being told what to think or what to do or how to act. They're being invited to explore issues, to deal with it themselves, to come up with some personal choices, to decide on some alternatives, to discover them, embrace them, try them, reject them. So that whilst on the one hand at school and university they are accessing information in ways which esteem them and respect them, when they come to churches they're actually no longer esteemed or respected, they're treated like nongs and we know everything and we'll tell you how it should be. What I'd like to suggest to you is that there are a number of values that we need to embrace in communicating to young people about Christianity. So basically six values for mission to young people. Sounding almost like a lecture, I tell my students, six values for mission. Write them down. The first one is, get the tape. The first one is, I think, firstly, respect. Communicating to young people involves us being prepared to embrace respect for young people. And respect primarily for the image-bearing aspect of young people's lives. See, fundamentally, Christian theology tells us that there are two different ways the Bible looks at human beings. When the Bible speaks about us, what does it tell us about us? On the one hand, it tells us what? That we are sinners. That we have all fallen short. That we are broken. That we are all affected by original sin. We are born into sin. Human beings are sinners. But that's not all that the Bible tells us about human beings. It tells us something else, almost opposite, and to be held in balance with that. What else does it tell us? That we are made in God's image. Now, it's sure that the fact that we are sinners has tarnished the degree to which we're made in God's image. There's no question about that. But human beings have been made in God's image and are sinners. How many of you have seen the film, Steven Spielberg film, Schindler's List? It's a Christian parable made by a Jew seeking to promote the Jewish cause. But if you have a look at Oskar Schindler, he is the ultimate archetypical human being. For the first half of the film, there is nothing redeeming about this particular man at all, is there? Not only are despicable and evil and dreadful and violent and horrible things occurring all the way through the film, but the so-called hero or the star of the show is an adulterer, a drunkard, a glutton, a man who's getting rich thanks to the Holocaust, a man who is using Jewish slave labour to get wealthier and wealthier. He's a despicable and vile and horrible person. His wife comes to him and says, I want you to stop sleeping around with other women. And what does he say? Well, take me as I am, I'm sorry, that's the way it is. He drinks and eats with Nazis. I mean, he is a party to the whole process. So while you're watching this film, you're thinking, well, now this is the star of the show, and where has this got to go? It's all downhill from here. It's despairing. Except halfway, I presume it's about halfway, I haven't timed it, at some point during the film there's actually a conversion scene. It's not very subtly expressed to us. Steven Spielberg sort of tends to overplay things a bit. But do you remember the little flash of colour in the midst of a black and white film? Where does that little flash of colour appear? Anyone remember? The little girl's pink or red dress. That's Steven Spielberg actually signalling to us that the film is starting to turn on its axis. So after this man has just behaved in the most despicable and depraved kinds of ways, what does he begin to do in the second half of the film? Change. In what specific ways does he begin to change? All the money that he's accrued, thanks to the Holocaust, what does he do with it? He buys his factory and creates, if you like, his own, if you like to call this, his own concentration camp. He buys Jews to save them. He literally spends the second half of the film giving away all the money he accrues in the first half in order to do noble and compassionate things. He stops sleeping with other women. You notice that he stops engaging wholeheartedly in the process of the victimisation of Jews. In other words, what you've got is a man who the first half of the film behaves in the most depraved ways, the most vile and despicable ways, and who in the second half of the film acts out the most noble, the most courageous, the most loving and the most compassionate of lifestyles. A man who's now revered as a model for us of great compassion and mercy. What you've got in Oskar Schindler is every single human being. He's an archetype. Built into each one of you and I is the capacity for both depraved and vile and despicable behaviour and the capacity for noble, gracious, godly acts of compassion and mercy. You are potentially Oskar Schindler. He's just Oskar Schindler to he's just humankind to the ultimate degree. Does that make sense to you? He becomes archetypical, therefore, I am Oskar Schindler, you are Oskar Schindler, I am capable of being both depraved and noble equally and at the same time. In fact, Scott Peck uses the illustration of the dragon. Have you read The Road Less Travelled? He uses the illustration of the dragon. He says, every one of the five major religions at every major epoch in history have told stories about dragons. Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Christians and Buddhists have all told stories about dragons. And the point that he makes is a dragon is actually a snake that can fly. Why does the dragon image appear so regularly right across human history and throughout different human religions? Because fundamentally it says something very basic to us about us. It says we are snakes, deprived on our bellies, and we can fly. It's this coalition, this balance between these two realities, made in the image of God and sinners. Now, that was a little theology lesson. What do you reckon? Now, when we go to evangelise young people, which side of the equation do we almost fall over ourselves to tell them about? Exactly. But we are primarily concerned with telling them that they are sinners, that they are fallen, that they are deprived. Now, we dress it up. We might use terms like depraved and evil and wicked and vile. But nonetheless, we are falling over ourselves to emphasise to them how far they have fallen short. Now, that is a biblical reality. I'm not suggesting that we abandon it. It's quite true. But it's equally true that they are made in the image of God. Is that not right? Yeah. Now, the degree to which they're made in the image of God is affected by their sinfulness. I realise that. But what difference would it make to us in the way we communicate to young people if we began to tease out the other side, without abandoning our recognition that they are fallen, that they are sinners just as we are? What difference might it make if we began to just as equally fall over ourselves to let them know how much they reflect God's image? Do you think that we might begin to develop a greater sense of respect for the people we're seeking to minister to? Theologians have actually identified the three primary ways in which human beings reflect God's image. Stay with me on this, even though it's late in the afternoon, it sounds like I'm bursting into great swaths of theology. But T.C. Hammond first identified these three ways in which human nature reflects God's image. He says we reflect God's image firstly because we are creative as we have come from one who is creative. We as creative human beings reflect the Creator. Now, whenever you say that, you say, well, I'm not very creative. I'm not very good at, you know, creating things. But when I say creative, don't think I mean poetry and art and songwriting, although I certainly do mean that. The desire to build, to produce, to create is built into the human psyche. Listen, you drive past some front yard somewhere where there's like six or eight guys with their sleeves rolled up, car parts all over the front yard, their heads under the bonnet of a car, pulling the thing apart, putting it back together. Do you think that's creativity? You ask young people, why? Why? What is it? What is it that ticks away inside you that just loves to pull this thing apart and put it all back together again? Where does that urge come from? Where does that desire to build, to produce, to pull apart, to put back together come from? I believe it comes from God. I believe your very desire not to go to church and to stick your head into your car bonnet and pull your engine to pieces is actually an act of worship. You may not know it, you may not identify it as worship, but it's you responding to an innate godly desire. I want to create. Now, some businesses want to create businesses, create careers, still creation. Some people want to create perfect gardens, still creation. I used to live in the garden suburb of Sydney, Castle Hill. Never felt very at home at Castle Hill. In fact, I think they used to call the council to come and get us out of Castle Hill because we didn't cut our lawn every second day. But we had a guy next to us, I'm sure he had the whole yard gridded up on some computer, screen. I'm sure he went down into his basement, it was like the Pentagon down there, you know what I'm saying? And every time a weed dared poke its head up, some alarm would go, bah, 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 weed in sector 4. You know, this guy was out squirting weeds, cutting lawns, trimming edges, and you think to yourself, why? What is this innate desire for neatness, for order? Where does it come from? You tell me. It comes from God. If we go to young people and we say, I know why your head's under the bonnet of that car, I know why you've produced this or sung that or listened to this, that's God built into your psyche, built into your nature, built into your spirit. And maybe not say it in so many words, but begin to go from the perception that you already reflect God. Let me just tease it out into your consciousness a bit. Now, I said there were three. Are you all still with me? First one is that we are creative as we come from a creator. Second, we are moral as we come from one who is righteous. But basically built into the human psyche are some fundamentals about right and wrong. Now, I don't think you find in any other sector of society, more so than in young people, a heightened sense of justice, of right. I used to be an English teacher. I can tell you this. There is nothing more despicable to a young people than to have a teacher set homework and not correct it. Even the kids who didn't do their homework, deep down inside, want you to ask for it. Why? Because to not ask for it is to say what to young people? Your choices make no difference to me whatsoever. Here's your homework. If you don't do it, I don't care. In effect, what I would be saying was, your choices, you doing the right thing or the wrong thing, doesn't make any difference to me whatsoever. So deep down inside, even if I didn't do my homework, even though I'm sweating on the teacher asking, even if I'm thinking, oh, please God, please God, please God, don't make him ask for it, there is something basic, very innate, that says if you don't ask me, there's a sense in which you don't care about me. Human beings have a high, human beings and young people in particular have a heightened sense of some basic rights and wrongs. And don't mishear me. Doesn't mean we always choose the right. Doesn't mean we always do what is, that's certainly the case with young people, but the basic sense of justice, the classic Australian cry, well, it's not fair. What is that? What made you think there was fair in the first place? Where does it come from? I have a friend who's a rabbi, Jewish rabbi, who teaches religious education in Jewish schools. He says that he goes into his class, first class up, he says, tell me something. He said, how many of you think that the Holocaust was wrong? Now, you can imagine how that goes down with a bunch of Jewish kids. They all put their hands up. He says, how many of you think that Hitler was wrong? All his hands go up. He says, why? Well, because he killed 6 million Jews, they say. Oh, yeah, he says, but he didn't actually break any laws. See, the Third Reich passed laws allowing everything that he did, so he didn't break a law technically, did he? Well, mate, they're furious by this stage. Oh, yes, he did. Well, tell me, How can you prove to me that, you know, exterminating Jews in Nazi Germany, when the Third Reich is, through the Reichstag, agreed to all this, didn't break a single law, how can you tell me that he's wrong? He said, in the end, he gauges them so much that they are swinging from the chandeliers. They're just about to throw things at him. When he then turns to them and he says, so what you're telling me is no matter what the law of the land says, there are some things in this world that are wrong because they're wrong because they're wrong. And when they scream, yes, he says, well, where did that idea come from? And where did it come from? That comes from God. You sit down with someone and you say, well, look, personally, I'm not into having sex with little children, but if that's your cup of tea, go right ahead. Why do we find that statement abhorrent? Well, why if I came to you and I said, oh, actually, I've heard that in some state in America, some little girl fell down a well and they spent $10 million fishing her out again. I don't know about you, but I think you could spend that money better some other way. When you think, oh, come on, where does that response come from? There's some fundamentals built into the human psyche. We are moral, and young people are highly righteous in some respects. Without necessarily being bound to make the right choices, they still have a strong sense of the righteous. Elie Wiesel, one of my favourite writers, storyteller, Pulitzer Prize winning Jewish storyteller, tells the story of this guy who dies and goes to heaven. And when he gets there, St. Peter is sitting at a desk, and there's two doors, heaven and hell. St. Peter's got his feet up on the desk, he's having a cup of coffee. He goes, oh, he said, I completely forgot about you. He said, of course, that's right, you were coming through. Look, I have been flat out all morning, I'm absolutely exhausted. I've got a glut of people coming through in about half an hour. This is the only break I'm going to get all day. Listen, just choose a door and go through. And the guy says, well, you don't just choose a door and go through, like, I thought this would be judgment or something. You got a big book there, you look at all the bad things I've done, all the good things I've done, you kind of go through my life or something. Yes, says Peter, that's the normal practice. But now, I mean, you know, if I do it with you, I'm going to break all day. So, like, just dispense with this for this. Just choose a door, go ahead. And the guy says, well, hang on a second. I mean, I've done a lot of good things in my life. I've done some bad things in my life. And I mean, I assume that at some point you kind of go through all this sort of business. I mean, doesn't God see all and know all? I mean, why don't you just choose a door? I can't just choose a door. I mean, open the book. I want to go through this sort of stuff. And Peter is saying, I'm not opening the book. This is the only break I'm getting all day. Well, you just choose a door. And in the end, the guy chooses the door to hell. And Wiesel's point in the story is this. You couldn't bear to cope with the belief that your actions didn't make a difference. That if you could really be told that your choices don't matter, whether you choose right or wrong doesn't really matter, if you really believe that, you might as well go to hell. Now, do you agree? I agree entirely. And where does that yearning come from? I believe it's part of God's image built into us. So firstly, we are, take a breath, we are creative, we are moral, and the third one that T.C. Hammond outlines is that we desire connection with this earth or with the created order. We desire connection with the created order. God, I believe that God actually created us to be stewards of the earth. Do you believe that? You watch the way in which it seeps out in even the most irreligious young person's life. Why do young people search for the perfect wave? Why? Why is it this driven desperation to be at one with the sea? Why do kids more often than not feel really peaceful when they're sitting on a mountaintop or a headland or a beach? Why do people feel drawn in their most desperate times to find space? Why is it that when people are really struggling with personal issues, they don't go and sit in the middle of the street in the middle of a suburb? Why is it that asphalt and curbing and guttering and tiled roofs don't make us feel at peace? Sorry? Exactly. Exactly. What we desire is some connection with the earth as God built that into us. Why? Why can't I feel at one when I'm in the middle of the suburbs? Why can't I feel at one when I'm in the middle of a skyscraper? Why do I feel better? Why is my head clearer sitting on a headland or on a mountain peak? Because God built that into me. Now, that's just a snippet of basic theology. But are you all with me? My point is this. If we began to tease some of this stuff out in young people's lives, the opportunities for communication would be overwhelming, wouldn't they? Don't abandon the call that we are sinners. We are. But when do you feel most aware of your sin? When someone's just told you're a sinner, or when you are close to God? when you're taken to the place of being close to God, no one needs to tell you you're a sinner, do they? Now, don't get me wrong. I do tell people that they are sinners. I do explain the concept of sin. I'm not ashamed of it. I think it's an extremely realistic way of understanding human nature. But my concern is, if that's all we tell them, how can we respect them? But if we can say, hey, listen, I've spent a lot of time with you. I can see you're a very creative person in this particular way. You tease it out. You affirm it and you confirm it. Where does that come from? I think God built that into you. You're respecting them and you're moving them along in a process. Have you ever said to a young person, hey, you're really good at that. I reckon when you leave school, you could probably become a such and such, and watch their eyes light up? I mean, it's the classic adolescent, who am I search. Give me some information. Their radar is up and they're just looking for signals. Who am I? What will I become? How should I be? Now, don't lie to them and don't build up false hopes, but give genuine feedback. You're a very compassionate person. You're great with people. You probably end up doing something in this world that, you know, really helps others. Now, they're not going to fall at your feet and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. I never realised that before. But you watch them store that one away in the back of their head. Respect them. That's the process of communication. Sure. Absolutely. There is this kind of false humility. Oh, shucks, no, I'm not. And you don't have to kind of get into a fight of saying, yes, you are. No, you're not. Yes, you are. But you watch them. They'll file that away. That goes back into some file way back there at the rear lobe of their brain. They won't let that one go. And as I said, you better make sure you're honest about it. You better not tell them stuff that's not true. But when you see it, spot it. When you see their creativity, when you see their desire for righteousness, when you see their connection with the earth, tease it out and get them to think it through. What you're affirming is that they come from God and they reflect something of His nature. The second thing is participate. The second major thing. The first one was respect. The second major thing is participation. That we ought to engage young people in participation in growth and discovery. I mentioned a good deal of this in the session before. If you weren't there, I apologise to some degree because I don't want to go back over it in great detail. But in essence, that the best way to communicate with young people is to journey with them together, to take them on a search for God, to get them involved in processing through the information. That's the best way to communicate. I tell you what, I speak at lots of youth camps, so I'm actually cutting back. I'm doing less and less. It's an enormous amount of time, youth camps. But I'm on a youth camp in Margaret River in Western Australia, and there are caves in Margaret. Are any of you into caving here? You have done? I'm personally not into it. I had never done it before. We go to this youth camp. They said, we thought we'd put caving on Saturday afternoon or whatever it was, just a time filler. We really want to preach the gospel to a mic, so, you know, it's the sessions that's really important, but, you know, we'll do a bit of caving. Do you know that the most important learning time of the whole camp was the caving? It was absolutely extraordinary. I went in a group with six people, one of whom had very slight cerebral palsy. We weren't going to, you know, caves where you pull the generator handle and all the lights come on. We're going into pitch black caves, and each group was allowed one torch each. It was not a designed activity. We only just had one torch each. That was all there was to it. So when you're walking through pitch black with six people, what has to happen to the torch? Somebody up the front has to shepherd people through, pass the torch up. Someone up the front has to shepherd people through, pass the torch up. We were having to, in some cases, drag this guy with the minor cerebral palsy through little holes in the rocks. The effect of teamwork, connection, shepherding, caring, loving. Man, I've just made so much mileage out of that in terms of speaking. The times when I could say, remember Sandra when we were doing such and such, all the lights go on because just about every other group had exactly the same experience. We've got to discover that these kinds of things are not just fillers, they're not just social activities, they're not just a bit of fun and then we'll get to the real business. We've got to begin to see how we can do the real business in the process of participation. Now, going on a food frenzy at McDonald's, I've yet to discover how you can do the real business in a situation like that. But actually exploring activities out of which principles can be drawn is part of the process of communicating to young people. Thirdly, servanthood. We are here to reflect Christ, and Christ came to serve.
here for him, but
I don't know if you've heard of the William Wordsworth quote, that best portion of a man's life are his small unremembered acts of kindness and love. Have you heard that quote? That best portion of a man's life, excuse the gender exclusive language, it's a long since forgotten era. The best portion of a man's life are his daily unremembered acts of kindness and of love. Do you believe that? The best portion of your life are those daily unremembered acts of kindness and love. See, we think the world is changed by the great breakthroughs, don't we? By the big sermons, by the famous people, by the big programs. We think that rich people, famous people, influential people change history. I'm absolutely convinced that the millions of people who follow Jesus and daily commit themselves to the process of serving in Christ's name, they are the people who actually, over the scheme of time, change history. Are you naive enough to believe that as well? I'm naive enough to believe that. I'm naive enough to dare to believe that that can possibly be the case. But our call to follow in Jesus' footsteps and to serve others and to treat them with enormous respect and gratitude is what will change us. I was keenly discovered this when I was in sixth grade at Brookvale Public School in Sydney. I did sixth grade twice as a kid. The reason for that was because I have a sister who's a couple of years older than me, who's intellectually disabled. They used to say retarded when I was a kid. It's a dreadful term, isn't it? But Joanne was retarded as far as they were concerned. So Joanne and I went off to Brookvale School, and from the age of five, I have a daughter who's now five, I couldn't imagine doing this to her, but from the age of five I was responsible for Joanne from the time of 9 a.m. until 3 p.m. every day. Walked her to school, got her into class, got her out of class at recess, put her back in at the end of recess, got her out at lunchtime, got her a lunch, got her back into classroom, got her out of school at the end of the day, walked her home. From the age of five, I carried around this extraordinary burden of responsibility for my sister. Now, classically, what happened to me was that I became an extremely, extremely responsible and well-behaved boy. I had to. I was operating for two people here. As a result, even adulthood, I still have issues of over-responsibility that I work hard to deal with. When I was 10 and in the fifth grade, they built a school down the road for people just like Jo. They'd been repeating her two or three years in the same year every so often. So she'd be a big 10-year-old back in third grade, stuff like that. They built a school for her down the road and Jo left, went off to a special school. So at the age of 10, in the fifth grade, having carried this burden of my sister around for all of my life, they take her away from me. Can you imagine what happened to me? I just turned into Bart Simpson from hell. I went totally ballistic. I'm not kidding. I became a juvenile delinquent overnight. I was talking about extortion and stealing and lying and cheating and fighting and the works, non-stop. It was just, I can't begin to tell you the kind of stuff I was into. Just went ballistic because I didn't know who Michael Frost was anymore. Michael Frost was the guy that looked after Joanne Frost. Now there's no Joanne Frost to look after. So it reached a high water mark when I actually locked our fifth grade teacher in the storeroom and organised a classroom strike for better conditions. You can imagine how this kind of thing goes down, can't you? You think it sounds ridiculous, and I can't imagine it now, but we actually drew up a list of things, and I went down to the principal, Mr. Miller, knocked on his door. Excuse me, Mr. Miller, we've got Mrs. Powell in the storeroom upstairs, and we've got this list of demands. I mean, can you imagine what he did to me? During that year, I just used to front to his office for my regular, series of the cuts. So those were the days when he had the cane. I was belted black and blue. I mean, it was just one thing after another, totally crazy, all through fifth class, all through sixth class. I'm about to graduate from sixth class and go to Manly Boys High School, the school I eventually went to. And the group I was hanging around with were a pretty bad bunch, and so they were going to go on to Manly Boys High School, and from there they were going to go off and sort of matriculate to various penitentiaries all around the state. So Mr. Miller calls my parents in. He'd actually discovered they had not died in a bushfire, as I told them, and that was the reason why they weren't responding to all his letters. You know, he found out they were actually still alive and well, and invites them in and sits them down. All unbeknownst to me, he says, "Listen, Michael spent 5 years at this school, and he's just a little sweetheart. He's a lovely kid. We took Joanne away from him and he went crazy." Mr. Miller knew exactly what was going on. He said, "You know what I suggest we do? I suggest that we repeat in the sixth grade. The bunch that's coming up from fifth grade are actually a really good bunch. The bunches we now are dreadful. Let them go. Bring a new bunch in. Might be a circuit breaker, because I'm born in June. I was a bit younger than everyone anyway. So there are some good reasons to do it. Let's see if this doesn't do the trick." This is all unbeknownst to me. I turn up because I thought everyone told me I was just too young. For my first day of my second year of sixth class, I'm sitting in the desk right up against the principal's, right up against the teacher's desk. I don't know why I had that desk. They just always made me sit there. The new teacher walks in. He was brand new to the school. I still remember today. It was the first time I ever saw Jesus in my life. Mr. Flood, his name was. He walked into the classroom, nicotine-stained fingers, nicotine-stained teeth. Turned out he was a cricket fanatic, and he used to take us to the Sydney Cricket Ground in his combi. Could you imagine getting away with that these days? But anyway, Mr. Flood was, well, he was Christ to me. He walked into that room and he said, "Good morning, I'm new to the school, I'm the new deputy principal, I'm your new teacher, my name is Mr. Flood." And he looked down at me, he leaned on his knuckles over his desk and over mine, and he said, "And you're Michael Frost, aren't you?" To which I responded something like, "Well, as a matter of fact, I am." I will never forget what he said to me next. It actually changed my life. He said, "I've heard all about you, son, but I don't believe a word of it." Now, to this day, I can still hear that. To this day, I still have to wipe the hair down on the back of my neck. "I've heard all about you, son, but I don't believe a word of it." I can still remember thinking, I can be good again. It was as if he took that bit of paper on my desk with all the scribbling and smudges and all the mistakes and all the carry-on and all the hangman pictures and all the things I'd done wrong. It's like he wrung that out. He threw that aside and he offers me a fresh sheet of paper. See, the wonderful thing I found about Mr. Flood was this. He could have come in and he could have said, "You're Michael Frost, aren't you? Well, so help me, son. You will do A, B, C and D, or so help me, I will do E, F, G and H." But you know something? He never once said a single word like that. He just said, "I don't believe a word of it." Who did he make responsible for my change? I tell you what, I took it like there was no tomorrow. Mr. Flood helped me out because he made me class captain, school captain, bellboy, lunch boy, milk boy, right here. He just poured the responsibility on there and helped me kind of come to grips with life. But that single moment of a man offering me a fresh start stays with me, so that when, like 8 years later, someone actually told me about a guy called Jesus who does the same thing, who dies on the cross so that I can begin again, I thought, I've heard this before somewhere. But where had I heard it? With Mr. Flood. See, part of us communicating to young people is offering fresh starts. And have you offered some fresh starts to people when you thought to yourself, how many jolly fresh starts can these guys take? Well, there'll be times like that, won't there? How many times, Lord, do we forgive someone? Is it 7 times 7? How many times are we called to forgive? Over and over and over. As servants, we are called not to compromise our principles or to go weak on the knees if people disagree with us, but as communicators to young people, to regularly offer grace, to regularly offer fresh starts, to model what it looks like when we can say, "Yes, I've heard all about you. I've heard all the stories of all the girls you've slept with in this church. I've heard all the stories about all the stuff that you've been up to. I've heard them, I've heard them, and I've heard them. And I'm not going to be naive about it, but from this moment on, I'm prepared to imagine, but I don't believe a word of it." So I don't doubt for a minute he believed every word of it. But as far as his relationship with me was concerned, like a servant, he was prepared not to believe a word of it. Do you understand what I'm saying? Has that been your experience? Well, let's lead on to the next one because it directly bears. The next one is our common humanity. We go to young people sharing a common humanity with them. We go to young people seeking to tease out the image-bearing nature, but at the same time, modelling what it looks like to be realistic about your sin. Modelling what it looks like when we confess our sins. Every year, I teach youth ministry at Morling College. Every year, I say to my class, they never cotton onto it, so it's been working okay for the last 3 years. I say, tell me, what are the young people out there like that we're trying to win? And away they go. Yeah, they're hedonistic, they're materialistic, they're pagan, they're this, they're that, they're the other. They list them all down. And I listen. I don't write any of them down. I don't say good, thank you, yes. I just listen. Anymore. Until finally, and it's happened every time, every semester, twice a year, somebody says, actually, he said, they're just like us. And that's the right answer, my friends. They are just like us. If we go out into this world aware of what we share in common with them, even if we extrapolate out beyond youth ministry, if we talk about married people, just because we're Christian doesn't mean our marriages are all okay like that, does it? Just because we're Christian doesn't mean we love paying our taxes and don't find ways to dodge them. Just because we're Christians doesn't mean we don't break the road rules. And likewise in our ministry to young people. Just because we're Christians, we haven't got life sorted out. Just because we're Christians, we haven't got self-esteem all the time. Just because we're Christians, we don't know ourselves completely and perfectly. We're still struggling through issues of identity and esteem and value and purpose and calling and vocation. All of those kinds of things. We share a commonness with young people. That doesn't mean to say that we have to be dopey, immature young people ourselves, does it? I mean, there's nothing worse over the long haul than a youth worker who tries to be one of the kids. Have you seen those ones operate? They last really effectively for a short period of time. Either they burn out or they get kicked out because young people just don't, over the long haul, buy that kind of nonsense. They don't want their 30-year-old youth worker to act like he's 15. They don't want their 25-year-old youth worker to behave like she's 14. They want to know what it looks like a few more steps down the road. But by the same token, they don't want you to come on like gangbusters, like you've got it all sorted out. My marriage is jolly hard work. I don't know what yours is like. My sense of purpose and vocation takes continual struggles. My sense of vocation is not clear to me every minute of every day. I don't value myself all the time, and I regularly abandon my experience of grace. It's about us being prepared to truly understand what common humanity is like. Now, here's homework for you. How many of you have seen the film Priest by Antonia Bird? Has anyone seen the film Priest by Antonia Bird? Shame, shame, shame. I tell you what, I saw it in Brisbane of all places. I was up here for a conference. I was staying with a Christian and Missionary Alliance bloke. You know that mob? I mean, very, very, very conservative group. I was staying in his place. He said, we've got a bit of time, what do you want to do? I said, I really want to see this movie called Priest. He said, Priest, that sounds good. Yeah, I'd like to see that. So I said, well, let's check out when it's on. We had to call around. It was on hardly any cinemas. It was all over Sydney. I don't know if Brisbane just didn't go for it or not, but we finally found a cinema that's showing it, and it's on in like 10 minutes. It was like a 15 or 20 minute drive into town. We zoom into town, we park the car, we run up, we arrive, we miss the shorts, we just get there as it's just about to begin. Oh, thank goodness, we're still puffing and heaving. Phew, oh, we made it. And he turns to me and he says, what's it about? I said, just watch, you'll really like it. I tell you what, have you heard of anything about him? Yeah. It's about a gay priest. It's about a man who feels called of God but struggles with his sexual orientation. It shows some very explicit homosexual love scenes, so be warned. But it is an extraordinary, extraordinary depiction of what it looks like when a sinner gets called to do mission. Now, irrespective of your views on homosexuality, I am not at all endorsing homosexuals in Christian ministry. So do you want to know, let me lay my cards on the table, I'll do that for you. But the point here is this, the homosexuality issue aside in this film, he is a flawed, sinful, broken character, but who just wants nothing more than to fulfill his vocation to serve Christ. And there are some beautiful and powerful images that occur in that film. I turned to him after it was over, expecting him never to speak to me again, and there were tears dripping off his nose and the bottom of his chin. I'm a terrible one at crying because I have to cry like that, you know. I can't. Yes, people can just let the tears run down their cheeks. I have to go. I was bawling my eyes out. I won't spoil it for you. Get it on video. Rent it and watch it. You'll be shocked by some scenes, but what you will watch is a man who's called. Now, this scene I want you to watch for. This gay priest, not wanting to be gay, wanting to be celibate, wanting to be a priest and fulfill his vocation, sits down with another old priest and he says, haven't you ever struggled with celibacy? Haven't you ever struggled with your sexuality? And this big, fat, ugly old priest is sitting there and he says, no, he says, I struggle with something much worse than that. And it's almost like, well, what's worse than that? And the young guy says, what have you struggled with? He said, I've struggled with something you find easy. He said, I've struggled with wondering whether I'm called. You know you're called. Do you know that you're called? Because if you're called, it's just the darndest thing that ever happened to you, isn't it? I had a young guy come to me after my evangelism class once at Morling and say to me, I think the Lord's called me to be an evangelist. And I said, oh, you poor thing. I'm so sorry for you. I've got that call too. It's like, there's no way out now, mate. God's put his finger on you. That's the lifestyle of an evangelist. That's the call. I can't wriggle out of it. I tried for a while, but I can't wriggle out of it. See, that's the call. And part of that package is I'm a sinner. I'm not homosexual, but I struggle with my sexuality, don't you? I struggle with my fantasy life. My eyes stray. I struggle with my ethics. I struggle with money. I struggle with just maintaining a commitment to the laws of the land, don't you? We can't go out there like we've got it all worked out just because Jesus came into our life and fixed things. The remarkable thing about Jesus is he doesn't fix things. The remarkable thing is that he invites us into a process of partnership with him, over which time things may well and truly get fixed. But it's all about process, isn't it? Our common humanity. Go out to people respecting the image-bearing aspect of their nature and go out aware of your own fallenness. That combination is a very, very potent one. There are two more things I just wanted to mention quickly. The first one I've already touched on is loving forgiveness. This is number 5. Loving forgiveness. I kind of strayed into that before when I was speaking about Mr. Flood. The regular expressions of forgiveness to young people. And then finally, truth. A commitment to truth. A commitment to being honest with ourselves and honest with young people and honest to the process. You know, George Bernard Shaw used to go off and hear Charles Spurgeon preach. George Bernard Shaw is one of the most famous atheists the world has ever seen. A very proud atheist. And people used to say, incidentally, Vincent van Gogh used to go and hear Charles Spurgeon preach. Wouldn't you have loved to have been in church on any given Sunday when Charles Spurgeon was going? You don't know who was going to be there. But G.B. Shaw used to sit there and listen to him preach regularly. And people would say to him, why do you do this? You don't believe any of that stuff. And his famous answer was, I don't believe any of it. But he does. And that's intoxicating. They may put you down and give you a hard time and laugh at you, but deep down inside, it's an intoxicating thing to see somebody who's really committed and really believes in the truth of that message that they've been called to bring. Very quickly, some essentials for this kind of principled evangelism. All youth ministries need to have a consistent evangelism philosophy and appreciate the needs and concerns of all youth. That's some of the material that we've been dealing with so far. It's helpful both to the young people as well as the organisers if we consider the following as essential to our evangelism process. I'll just read this through for you. Firstly, awakening. Young people, like all people, share a need to be reconnected with their Creator. Awakening them to this need by stimulating a personal search affords them dignity and respect through giving them the responsibility for their faith and not embracing that responsibility ourselves.